This is Cuerpa Política, a podcast about reproductive health, politics, and justice in Latin America, funded by the Institute of Latin American Studies and co-hosted by me, Dr. Rebecca Ogden, lecturer in Latin American Studies at the University of Kent.
And me, Dr. Rachel Sanchez Rivera, postdoctoral fellow in sociology at the University of Cambridge. Cuerpa Política explores reproduction in Latin America through a series of conversations with activists, practitioners, artists, and researchers working in many different contexts. Latin American countries have some of the world's most contentious reproductive health laws and policies, and there are persistent challenges facing the quest for reproductive justice.
In these episodes, our conversations with experts will explore contemporary issues, such as those relating to abortion access and obstetric violence, as well as histories of reproductive politics in the region, from the relationship between empire and reproduction, eugenics, 20th century fertility control measures, and beyond. In many of the episodes, we consider culture as a lens through which to understand these contexts, exploring how cultural norms, as well as media and the arts, shape the political, legal, and social realities of reproduction and vice versa.
Follow the podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you access podcasts, and get in contact with us via our social media at Cuerpa Política on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Barbara Sutton is a professor in the Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department at SUNY University at Albany. She's also affiliated with the Sociology Department and is an associate member of the Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino Studies Department. Professor Sutton's scholarly interests include body politics, human rights, collective memory, globalization, and women's activism, particularly in Latin American context. The topics she is drawn to are broad and diverse, but reflect an overarching concern with how systems of social inequality based on gender, race, class, sexuality, and nation structured embodied social experience. We hope you enjoyed this episode. So thank you very much for being with us today, Barbara. So many people might be familiar with the quest for abortion rights in Argentina, which has received more international media attention in recent years. But for the purposes of this short episode and to the benefit of our audience, could you provide a little background or context about the history of reproductive politics in Argentina and how the movement for reproductive justice has taken shape there?
Yes, and first, thank you so much for your interest in my work. So, first, I'd like to say that, as you know, the notion of reproductive justice includes both the right to have children and not to have children. I will be focusing more on the latter, particularly given the struggle to legalize abortion in Argentina and the salience of that these struggles achieved in the last decades, but especially in the last few years and months, kind of this struggle that to support women's ability to make decisions over their own bodies when it comes to reproductive matters. So abortion, decriminalization, and legalization is one such struggle. Just to give you a little bit of context, women historically were assigned a central role as mothers and as childbearers in the history of Argentina. And even in recent history, and specifically during the 70s, different governments, both constitutional and also we had dictatorships, implemented pro-natalist policies. For example, restricting the commercialization of contraceptives, and abortion was largely illegal until just a few months ago, basically. So after a dictatorship that went from 1976 to 83, and with the return of democracy, There were more opportunities for women, for feminist movements to demand reproductive rights. But democracy did not mean automatically that progressive policies and cultural changes would be implemented, particularly when it came to, you know, women's rights, women's bodily autonomy, including things like the use of contraception and abortion. You know, even in the 90s, there was a constitutional reform and conservative groups were pushing to include a clause in the constitution to defend life, they said, from the moment of conception. And this was averted, but still, you know, governments, for example, in, also in the 90s, there was the institution of the day of the National Day of the Unborn Child. So there were these kind of gestures, right? Even if symbolic, to assert, you know, this the preeminence of what they call the unborn child, and you know, and as a way also of avert progress when it came to women's rights to control their fertility. And in the early 2000s, you know, this was a very important time in terms of thinking about these issues, because this was a time of economic crisis and, you know, great social upheaval. So it was also like a time when, you know, we need to think about reproductive rights and the struggles for reproductive rights within that broader context of social upheaval and social movement activism. And it was a time where there were many movements that were demanding change from, you know, there were groups like neighborhood assemblies, unemployed workers organizing, workers recovering factories, students, many others. So feminist and women's organizations were part of this, you know, movement for social change. And within this struggle for reproductive rights became more popularized, including abortion, you know, became more common to discuss these issues, you know, both in within the women's movement, but also the political organizations more broadly. So, you know, interestingly, in the midst of all this social turmoil in the 2002, for example, national law on sexual reproductive health was passed, but abortion remained illegal. And another piece of information I'd like to share is kind of an important space in Argentina has been these Encuentros Nacionales de Mujeres, or National Women's Meetings. Lately, the name has been shifting to plurinational encounter of women, lesbians, trans, travestis, bisexual, and non-binary people, which also shows, you know, some of the changes within the movement and within society. But what I wanted to share is that these encuentros, you know, have been happening since 1986 and have been also like a space where demands for all sorts of changes and challenges to inequality have been, you know, taking shape, including for abortion rights. And it is in 2003, in the context of this encuentro, is when, you know, the green triangular kerchief or pañuelo that became identified with the movement, you know, and that is today very recognized, but was not necessarily at the time, you know, it was used by activists in that space. And in 2005, another important aspect, you know, has been the emergence of the National Campaign for the Right to Legal, Safe, and Free Abortion. And this is a coalition of hundreds of organizations across the national territory. They include, you know, human rights organizations, women's, feminists, LGBTQ groups, professional organizations, labor unions, students, like many different groups across society. And, you know, this campaign, you know, again, like we can see kind of the results today, but, you know, it is important to have this historical perspective because you can see the effects also of very patient grassroots multi-level, you know, multi-pronged organizing, which before legal reform, they achieved what they called the social decriminalization of abortions. I mean, there are multiple groups. Another group I think that is important to mention is Lesbians and Feminists for the Decriminalization of Abortion, which set up an abortion hotline in 2009. And it was important in terms of popularizing or disseminating information about the use of misoprostol, which is this pharmaceutical that can be used for self-managed abortions. Another group, which is actually part of the campaign, is Socorristas en Red. Socorristas can roughly translates as first responders. And this is a group that provides accompaniment to people who need abortions. And a couple more things I'd like to say about the campaign is like one of the strategies. I mean, there were many different strategies because they're really, you know, intervening in the media, universities, health institutions, at the neighborhood level, lobbying Congress, cost lawyering, you know, providing information, etc. But one strategy was to present bills, you know, to legalize abortion to Congress. And, you know, they did this multiple times. They were not even taken first for debate. And in 2018, you know, the movement did reach a milestone when, you know, at last it was debated in Congress. It passed in the Chamber of Deputies, but then it was rejected in the Senate. And though, you know, this was not what activists desired, it's still, this is an important moment in terms of energizing the movement, you know, creating momentum, creating a ton of visibility. The green kerchief was everywhere. You know, people were talking about this green tide in reference to, you know, to the pervasive presence of these kerchiefs, you know, everywhere. So, I mean, and just to bring it to today, finally, in, you know, in 2020, even in the midst of this COVID-19 global pandemic, and with so many obstacles, you know, the president of Argentina sponsored a bill to legalize abortion, and which gathered actually many of the movement demands. And Congress approved it in December of 2020. So, I mean, this is just like to give a little bit of historical, you know, background. You know, a couple of points that I like to highlight. One is that, you know, abortion legalization has been important not only for women, but also for people with other gender identities who can become pregnant and need an abortion, including trans men, non-binary, gender non-conforming individuals. And, you know, understanding this and making this a demand that is explicit was a whole process within the movement and also, you know, to change broader cultural perceptions. Another aspect that I'd like to highlight is that the new law, you know, provides a robust framework, not only in the sense that it allows abortion, you know, through the first 14 weeks of pregnancy, but it's also concerned with access. You know, it aims to guarantee abortion that is gratuito, which means free of charge. And, you know, it says that it has to be covered by the public, private, and social insurance systems. So this is one way to address some of the inequalities, you know, making sure that abortion is a right not just available for those who can pay for it, but also, you know, for people who have like barriers to access, whether economic, geographical, or, you know, or based on historical forms of discrimination. So, in other words, it's not just a matter of choice. And this is important because, you know, the movement, you know, choice is not the only frame that the movement has used. It is about choice. It is about bodily autonomy, but they also talk about human rights. They talk about social justice, public health, defending women's lives and also intervening as a pragmatic, in a pragmatic way, in the sense of showing both the ineffectiveness of the punitive law, but also the harm that it caused. I think that, this is important, again, just in terms of thinking about inequalities to keep, these particular characteristics in mind. And also, in addition to the abortion bill, simultaneously, a law known as the Plan of the 1,000 Days was also passed to provide financial and other forms of assistance to those who wish to continue their pregnancies. So the combination of both laws, I think, that provide, a more holistic notion of reproductive rights, supporting people who wish to continue their pregnancies, but also those who don't.
Thank you very much for that fantastic, historical background and overview. And just to discuss social movement activism and how it's very inclusive, not only we need to expand the definition of reproductive rights and reproductive justice to non-binary people, trans men, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought that was a great overview into the Argentinian situation. And now that we discussed the context of Argentina, we would like to explore its broader connections. One of the main questions that you pose in your book titled Bodies in Crisis, Culture, Violence, and Women's Resistance in Neoliberal Argentina is, what can we learn about Argentine society, and what about the interplay between global and local forces, especially when we discuss women bodily worlds? So could you elaborate on what inspired you to take women's bodily works as a point of departure for the analysis, or for this analysis specifically, and how you went about answering this question methodologically speaking?
Yes, thank you again. I think, when feminists say the personal is political, they point to how problems that may seem individual or even private are in fact shared, how they are rooted in social, cultural, and political structures. These are forces that systematically disadvantage certain groups, and in this case, women, though they don't do it in the same ways across class or race, ethnicity, or sexuality, or disability status, or other vectors of inequality. So in some ways, my intellectual curiosity regarding body politics in Argentina was shaped by my personal experiences. I grew up in Argentina. I lived there as a young adult. And when I later studied sociology, I started to make some connections between my experiences, the way women's bodies were represented and conceptualized in Argentine society, for example, in the media or cultural norms, in the law, forms also of violence playing out in the bodies of women, and also how broad social developments such as state violence or economic crisis have affected women's bodies specifically. So when I started to be interested in these issues, I simultaneously reflected on my own bodily experiences and wondered to what extent they overlapped or differ from those of other women. And I was struck also by the paradox that on the one hand, there was an hypervisibility of women's bodies, for example, in the media, presented with scant clothing in magazine covers, on billboards, oftentimes sexualized, used to sell products as props or adornment, right? So there was that aspect, but at the same time, there was an invisibility of women's bodily experiences narrated in their own terms, whether it was experiences of violence or reproductive issues or bodies at work, etc. So at the time I conducted my research in the early 2000s, I had not seen many works or practically any work about women's embodied experiences and narrative about their body. So my work intended to be a bit exploratory in that sense. I conducted in-depth interviews with diverse women in which we talked about their bodily experiences. I tried to reach to women in different occupations, you know, women who had different levels of education, income, sexual identities, race, ethnicity, ages, religion, among other, you know, life experiences. So I interviewed 50 women individually and then also conducted 4 focus groups, 4 to 7 women each. And at the time that I conducted the research, which was during 2002 and 2003, Argentina was still reeling from this severe economic and political crisis after the economy collapsed in late 2001. And so this context deeply affected my work, including in ways I had not anticipated. And so did also the social movement activism that was sprouting everywhere and that I wanted to be part of. Like, I wanted also to be part of social change. Not, you know, it was not a matter of doing research, but like personally, I wanted to participate in those spaces. So at the time, though, I also then decided that it would be important to interview activist women. So about half of the women I interviewed individually were activists. You know, they were members of the Picketeer movement or, you know, feminists, labor organizers, women running communal kitchens, popular assembly participants, lesbian rights activists, members of human rights organizations, organizations for the rights of Afro-descendants and indigenous peoples and sex workers and migrants from other Latin American countries and people with disabilities. So I really got like a broad range of perspectives and experiences. I was also examining media representations. I kept a journal of my own bodily experiences and conducted ethnographic observations of everyday life. And as I mentioned, at the same time, I was also involved in social movement activism. And so the lines between my personal interest in being part of social change and my research observations at times blurred, in the sense that, you know, I kept my sociological eyes open, you know. And methodologically, I really try to bridge these different scales, you know, like from the most macro, such as the economy or politics with capital P, you know, to the most micro level, like the level of the body and specifically women's bodily experiences. You know, I was interested in questions like, so how does the economic crisis affect women's bodies? How does, you know, social class affect the intimate bodily experiences of abortion? You know, what is it like to poner el cuerpo, like to put, you know, the body on the line in political protest against broader structures of inequality? So these are some of the issues I explored.
Thank you very much, Fernanda. And I think that leaves in a really good place, like, to our next question, like just thinking about your positionality, but also like, you know, as an Argentinian, like as an Argentinian scholar, but also as an activist, and how you see like this hyper visibility of women, but at the other side, like you see an invisibility, and how this links to race, class, compulsive heterosexuality and reproduction, especially thinking about motherhood and as a hegemonic mode of feminine embodiment. In this sense, like, how does Argentina uses like women's bodies like as a territory for civilizing the nation?
So you know, I think it's really great that you're connecting you know, bodies with this notion of territory in your question, or, you know, thinking about the body as a territory in which social, cultural, or, you know, political processes play out. And, you know, this is something that resonates with some feminist conceptualizations of women's bodies in Latin America, particularly indigenous communitarian feminisms that articulated the notion of body territory or cuerpo territorio as a way of linking processes of extraction, expropriation, you know, exploitation, colonization of lands and peoples, and the embodied experiences of women, particularly those marginalized and subordinated based on class or race, ethnicity, you know, gender, sexuality, and other, you know, intersecting social hierarchies. So in my research on abortion politics in Argentina in the last few years, some activists I interviewed, for example, articulated this notion of bodily autonomy and sovereignty, drawing on the notion of body territory. And I think this is significant because who controls the reproductive body, and more specifically, the concrete reproductive bodies of diverse people, you know, is one of the areas of political contention that reveal myriad inequalities in society. So, but to go back also to other aspects of your question, you know, in my book, In Bodies in Crisis, I outlined two areas where we can detect hegemonic modes of feminine embodiment to which women are held accountable to. So one related to appearance and one to motherhood. And I will talk a little bit about the motherhood aspect, given, you know, the connection to the discussion, you know, about reproductive justice here. But first, let me just say a few things about the history of Argentina in terms of, you know, how it includes a modernization project that promoted white European ideals. In that sense, we can think of women's bodies as territories in which elites' desires to civilize the nation would be applied. And this was partly due, you know, by or done by encouraging immigration from Europe and promotion of Europeanness more generally. And to this day, you can hear political leaders and recently the president, you know, continuing to repeat this refrain that Argentines descend from the ships, meaning migration from Europe. And in ways that erases really the diversity of people in the country, including indigenous communities, Afro descendants, you know, communities that have experienced all manners of violence and racism. So this process of civilizing the nation and women specifically entailed the promotion of identification of white Europeanness, including its heteronormative and patriarchal gender and sexuality arrangements. It meant also exalting white, middle, upper class, and, you know, heterosexual ways of being a woman. And motherhood played a central role in this configuration, you know, motherhood being idealized, naturalized, glorified in as a status for women in Argentine society, though not always counting with sufficient support, as the pandemic now more recently has been, you know, made painfully clear, right? So it is then important also to remember that not all women's statuses as mothers are equally valued. But women in general are still accountable to this ideal of motherhood and being oriented towards the needs of others. And this also has bodily implications for women. You know, you think about the maternal body and how it is supposed to be nurturing, all-giving during pregnancy and beyond. And there have been consequences also for women when they try to break with this motherhood mandate, for example, through abortion. Until recently, women seeking abortions had to operate in the context of clandestinity, in the context of a punitive law that penalized abortion with up to 4 years in prison, except in cases of rape or danger to the life or health of the woman. And even these exceptions were difficult to access. And, you know, some will say, well, most women were not going to prison for abortion, but still this didn't mean that the illegality of the practice was harmless, because it carried stigma, it fostered dangerous sanitary conditions, you know, exacerbated inequalities between women, between those who could pay for a relatively safe clandestine abortion and those who didn't. So, you know, it is important to realize that the weight of the law, of this punitive law that we had until very recently, exceeded its actual implementation. So those are a few things that perhaps, just to keep building our discussion.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's very important to know how like these tropes of desirability are always like racialized and how they tend to use like whiteness, heterosexuality, or compulsive heterosexuality, reproduction and class as the organizing principles to civilize. And now like, let's just like think, or let's just like move our conversation to like the resistance to it. I know that like in Poner el Cuerpo, you describe a social transformation as an embodied collective project. Why do you think we need to continue to take bodies into account to understand political resistance? Are there risks in focalizing the gendered body as a point of departure, particularly for feminist scholars?
Great question. I mean, I do think we need to continue taking bodies into account, both as sites of oppression and also sites of resistance. And actually, I teach a class focused on this matter in which we explore how women's bodies have been sites of oppression and resistance in different societies around the world. And in that sense, we can think about women's bodies as spaces where cultural wars might be played out, where hopes for ethnic survival are located, economic policies implemented or inscribed, sexual violence perpetrated. And in that sense, we can look at concrete social practices and ideas that are embedded in systems of inequalities, whether it's unequal, distribution of food or unrealistic beauty standards, or, how a work may be exploitative, or how violence is institutionalized. And so in that sense, we see the production of different kinds of feminist bodies, whether it's bodies that are hungry or that are sick or that are confined or that are exploited or hypersexualized, etc. But at the same time, as you were mentioning in your question, it is also important to recognize that social forces, even we can recognize that they are very powerful, that they shape our lives, our existence, but they do not determine completely, everything, that there is such thing as agency, in this case, women's embodied agency. And, in that sense, women as embodied subjects have also resisted power relations. They have demanded different forms of bodily existence, and they have fought also with their bodies in these struggles to reconfigure, society. And we can see this in different parts of the world, that, diverse women challenging, individually and collectively many different forms of injustice, whether based on gender hierarchies or heteronormativity, racism, colonialism, ableism, xenophobia, class expedition. All these powers, all these systems of power operate at the level of the body and are resisted also through bodies. And many women also, they're not just like, they're oppressed or resisting all the time. There's also other things that happen, in people's lives. And bodies can be also spaces for pleasurable experiences, for positive experiences, whether it is like to resist something or just to be, right? Just to live our lives with or without the approval of society. In doing so, I think the possibility for affirming sexual or sensual relations emerge, and also to have better connections with other people, with the natural world, in the way we live, we build our cities, our spaces, the spaces in which our lives unfold. And the other part I think that is important too, in terms of thinking about the body and resistance, is when it comes to political resistance, we can think about, for example, political protest and, political protest as forms also of embodied performances, and as ways in which also we see some of the contradictions and challenges of society playing out in those political spaces too, in terms of creating possibilities, but also presenting some challenges. And the last part of your question that had to do whether there are limitations of this approach or what are the risks. And I think that this is important to keep in mind because depending on how it is done, as you mentioned, there can be risks in focalizing too much on the body when it comes particularly to women, in the sense that there are already cultural views that essentialize women's bodies, that consider women as just bodies, or that try to claim that women's destiny is dependent on biology only. And so, to me, the trick is to try to reveal and challenge those social constructions without reinforcing them.
Yeah, definitely. And I think now that we're talking about like the social forces and how they enforce like maternal embodiment, how do women resist becoming just the maternal body?
All right. So, I mean, on the one hand, let me say that so maternal embodiment has been culturally, politically, legally, religiously promoted. That there's this whole social apparatus glorifying, mandating, demanding, enforcing motherhood. And like I said before, even though mothers do not get always the support they need, right? So resistance to this had to occur at many, at multiple levels. There is not just one space, right? I mean, when we talked about abortion, the law could be one space in which this mandate is challenged. At the same time, it is interesting because there's this assumption that, this contradiction between abortion and motherhood, while many women who have had abortions are mothers, it's just that it seems that like the mandate means that you cannot pause that ever, that this kind of mandatory expectation, that if you're pregnant, you will be mother, right, no matter what. So that has been one place. We haven't talked too much about religion yet, but when we think also about the impact of colonization in the Americas, we can also link it to the influence of religion and Christianity in particular. The majority of Argentines are Catholic, at least nominally, and the church as an institution has been influential. And recently, we can also see the growth of evangelical churches. And both, these Catholic evangelical institutions oppose abortion, and the religious movements also that accompany them have tried to influence the political process, including in terms of the debate for the decriminalization of abortion and legalization of abortion. Culturally, the Catholic Church has, for example, promoted the cult of the Virgin Mary, a figure that embodies chastity and motherhood simultaneously, which is a difficult combination for most women. Given the influence of the church in politics and policies, feminists have emphasized the need for Estado laico or a secular state. But also, in Argentine history, we can also see how this emphasis on motherhood as having a central role in society has sometimes been turned around and has been used as a form of resistance. So, for example, during the dictatorship, the last military dictatorship in Argentina, you may know about the emergence of mothers of Plaza de Mayo, women whose sons and daughters were disappeared by the dictatorship, meaning like the government kidnapped people and then they were denying that they had them captive, and you know, and killing people that they held in this clandestine detention center. So, so these women, mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, drew on their status as mothers to protest and to confront the biggest patriarchy, even though they were not putting it in those terms, but, you know, the patriarchy of the state controlled by a male-dominated institution such as the military that had the power to kill and torture its own population, and which they did. And in my my book, Surviving State Terror, I also explore how, you know, these ideas about motherhood played out in the context of clandestine detention centers. Because during the dictatorship, women were expected also to properly socialize their children so that they would not become what they call, the military calls, subversives, like people who challenge the regime, even, you know, in multiple ways, you know, not just through political organizing, but also with ideas. So, like I mentioned, you know, there were these clandestine detention centers, and massive numbers of people were taken, you know, were places where torture and other atrocities were implemented. And, you know, in the, my book also, I argue that, you know, pregnant women occupy this contradictory of ambivalent positions, because on the one hand, they embodied this gender duty to procreate, and in some cases, the very image of good woman who deserves special protection. But they were still, you know, on the other hand, they were still seen as subversives or partners of subversives or the mothers of future subversives. So in that sense, the pregnant body then was posing a challenge to a regime that was dedicated to the annihilation of groups of people deemed subversive. So while pregnancy then could afford certain protection in some cases, you know, pregnant women were not spared from torture, from sexual violence, from the appropriation of their children by the military, and ultimately assassination. So this is another space where we can think about kind of the, you know, how some of these gender constructs play out. And in my book, I also explore various forms of resistance by women and how the body played a role in that.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. Like, I think the role of colonization or colonialism and religion in the promotion or the historical promotion of maternal embodiment is like very important to understand, like, it's more like contemporary or its legacies and like how it can be used, like, or like the pregnant body can be used as a challenge as well, especially like when talking about La Madre de la Plaza de Mayo and like their like different like paradoxical dynamics here. And like in that sense, like in thinking more like after the neoliberal policies in Argentina, how do women's consciousness and embodied experience of neoliberal policies and economic crisis in Argentina serve as a site that illustrates the bodily implications of global economic restructuring?
So I believe that the experience of economic crisis in Argentina in connection to neoliberal capitalist restructuring continues to show the ways in which disembodied economic policies that in fact rest on and take for granted the embodied labor and time of women produce harm and exacerbate inequalities. And it also throws into relief how people are differently equipped to weather crises based on pre-existing social conditions, access to resources, and, you know, pre-existing inequalities. Economic crises can facilitate, for example, the emergence of hungry, ill, exhausted bodies, but this is not equally distributed across society. At the time, you know, I was you know, talking a little bit before about that period of, you know, in the context of the 2001 economic crisis and the social movement activism that emerged in that regard. So At the time, you know, activist women were not only talking about the feminization of poverty, for example, but they were also talking about the feminization of resistance. And women were at the forefront of many of the movements and struggles, you know, that emerged in those years. In my work, I show how many women had to grapple with problems like declining standards of living, or they had to deal with the disruption of taken for granted routines, or make health and nutrition compromises, or cope with disturbing emotions, you know, embodied emotions that were related to their own situations or to bearing witness of the suffering of others. All of these, like I mentioned, are embodied experiences. And this is to remind us too that the body can be depleted if there is an excessive demand, you know, particularly in a situation where the economic structures create vulnerabilities in many groups and sectors of the populations. And if you're also culturally and structurally positioned to attend, you know, to the needs of others and put your own needs in the back burner, you can see how a moment of crisis like this can be devastating in that regard. And, you know, I focus on women and drew particular attention to the challenges that women in marginalized and underserved communities were experiencing. And I keep thinking now how some of these, you know, processes, how of the things or, you know, that I learned, you know, that relate to this time in history still resonate today in these times of pandemics, you know, during this crisis of global proportions, where we still, you know, see this incredible demand on the bodies, on the time, on the emotions of women around the world, you know, sustaining families, sustaining communities, and just the complete inadequacy of the social support systems in place, and at the same time, kind of that a taken for grantedness of that, you know, someone will take care of this, and you know, the someone, you know, it's not like a random occurrence who is, you know, taking care of this. You know, I don't mean to say that women are the only ones, but I'm just saying that they are particular vulnerabilities and needs that that are at the intersection of gender, class, race, ethnicity, you know, migration status. I mean, all these vulnerabilities rooted in injustice, right? That we need to continue, you know, paying attention to. And I think looking at the embodied experiences of the, you know, the bodily scars, the bodily consequences offer also a window to understand the social suffering associated with these processes and giving us like a compass of some of the things that we need to really address as communities, as societies.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like highlighting the importance of the politics of care, inequalities and reproductive justice is like very imperative to understanding, for example, like contemporary dynamics such as like the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think because we're currently like talking about resistance, I would like us to focus on like transnational symbols and their importance. And I know that in your 2020 article with Naila Luz Bacareza, you examine visual interventions by abortion activist organizations in Argentina and speak about the green kerchief as a key symbol in the visual repertoire of the Argentinian abortion rights movement. In the sense, like the pañuelo, like has been taken up by activists in other contexts as well, and in Latin America, but elsewhere as well. Like even in Ireland, for example, where abortion was recently made in with a collaboration of Northern Irish and Peruvian feminists. So, in this sense, like why or in what ways do you think we need to pay attention to the propagation of activist symbols, which travel across like boundaries, like or borders in this way?
Yes, symbols such as the pañuelo verde or green kerchiefs are important, I think, to foster solidarity. They create identification. They also transmit emotions, can synthesize meanings or arguments that are important to a movement. And in the case of the abortion rights movement, also was important to bring out in the open and destigmatize a practice that for a long time had been taboo, right? So, you know, the pañuelo also created very vivid and embodied evidence of the strength and determination of the movement, particularly as, you know, we see the proliferation of its presence everywhere. Like I said, like, you could be in the streets, you could be in the subway, you could go to a meeting, to a conference, to a political gathering. And it was, you know, it was like very present. You know, the ways then in which this pañuelo and the color associated with it came to be part of what, you know, what is known now as the Green Tide, speaks both to the spread and the strength of the movement. And, you know, when, well, in Argentina, this pañuelo verde has its own resonance and its own genealogies, for example, in the ways that it resembles the pañuelo blanco, the white kerchief that identified the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. As this symbol, as this pañuelo travels across borders, it's not simply adopted mimetically. It's not just a copy or even just a translation. We can see how activists in different countries adopted and adapted the pañuelo verde with slogans, with you know, with inscriptions that resonates with their own local struggles, their own framings of abortion rights, their own demands. Actually, my co-author, Naila Bacaresa, has continued working on this role of visual symbols in the movement, including the trailing of the pañuelo and other symbols in the Southern Cone of Latin America. And she has a chapter about this in our forthcoming co-edited volume, which I let you know now, it's called Abortion and Democracy, Contentious Body Politics in Argentina, Chile, and Uruguay with Routledge. It's coming out in just a few weeks. So in her chapter, we can see this importance of symbols, bodies, and emotions in social movement struggles, including abortion rights activism, or especially abortion rights activism. But more broadly, I'd like to invite you to check out the whole book, and I hope you also find it interesting in terms of continuing these conversations also with a more transnational lens to it.
Thank you to the Institute of Latin American Studies, School of Advanced Study, University of London, for generously funding this project.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Cuerpo Política. Join us for a new episode every fortnight and click on the follow button to receive notifications about podcast episodes.